Hello and welcome to South Asia Chat, a podcast series brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. My name is Imran Ahmed. I'm a research fellow here, and I'll be your host for today's episode. Amidst turbulence and uncertainty, Pakistan recently held its much-anticipated general elections, where 266 seats in the National Assembly, the lower house of Pakistan's parliament, were contested. As results flowed in over several days, it was clear that the political landscape in the country stands at a critical juncture. Today, we delve into the complexities of this pivotal event with our guest, Dr. Zahid Ahmed, honorary fellow at Deakin University and a non-resident fellow at ISAS, to explore the implications of this event for governance, stability, and the country's socio-political future. Dr. Zahid, welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Imran.
Now, my first question. The most recent results published by the Election Commission of Pakistan states that independents had won over 100 seats, with Nawaz Sharif's Pakistan Muslim League, the party favoured by the security establishment, acquiring only 75. In your opinion, who won and did the army lose? And given these results, what are your thoughts on the potential challenges and opportunities for political stability in the country?
I think this is a million-dollar question. You know, everyone at the moment is wondering who actually has won the elections, because it took the Election Commission the longest than ever before to finalize the results. And last I checked, you know, the number for the independents dropped from, you know, earlier estimates to now at 93 out of 266. And you need about 130 seats to really form a government. And so at the moment, it's, you know, nothing is that clear. While there are other parties, they are, you know, arranging meetings with each other to pool in their seats and form the government. And there's quite, you know, quite a likely scenario that that might go ahead. But as far as the elections go, this is perhaps the most controversial elections in Pakistan. While in the late 70s, of course, the Zulfikar Ali Bhutto's election, and back then, of course, if you remember, the Awami League in East Pakistan had won the clear majority, but because of the military establishment's support, they were not, the People's Party of Zulfikar Ali Bhutto was favored, and that eventually led to also insurgency in East Pakistan and so on. So the crises are very much similar, because there was already a crackdown on Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, or the Imran Khan's party, and also his workers and supporters. Many of them are still facing multiple charges. Imran Khan, just leading up to elections, he was imprisoned for 14 years, then for 10 years, then for 7 years under different cases. And even the party's, you know, symbol, which is a cricket bat, was taken from them. So all of its candidates had to contest these elections as independent candidates. And that was perhaps the assumption, or the wrong assumption, of the establishment and its the parties that it is supporting, that would eventually or naturally lead to the Imran Khan party not receiving sufficient votes, because the you know, people won't know which symbol to vote for. But that didn't happen. This party still is the most popular party in the country. Imran Khan remains the most popular politician in the country, and they have a very strong social media presence. And because of all that, they were able to run this, you know, all, I think, mainly digitalized election campaign, very cost effective. And they were able to provide those details to their voters and supporters, that which symbol they had to vote for. And it worked, as you can see from the results. You know, it's very surprising for many. Earlier estimates had suggested that the independents could win as many as 130 seats. That didn't happen because of all the, you know, electoral troubles and mainly the rigging and the misconduct and all of that what happened in the past week or so. As far as the situation of Pakistan, Tehreek-e-Insaf, its approach is quite clear. They do not want to form a government in alliance with any of the other major parties like Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz or Pakistan People's Party. So basically the parties they have always been going against or blaming for all the corruption and Pakistan's trouble. So going ahead, it's very much now the ball is in the court of other political parties, and it's very likely they'll come to some kind of a compromise and form the government. If they don't do that within the given time frame, then of course the elections will have to be reorganized.
Can I ask, was it a surprise for you that the PMLN performed as it did?
Not really a surprise, you know. It was quite clear that the PMLN, or Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz, has been the military establishment's favorite leading up to these elections. And there's sufficient evidence to suggest that, you know, that was going to happen. For example, all charges against Nawaz Sharif were dropped and he was able to contest the elections. So basically favorable conditions were created for his party by also launching this crackdown on the most popular party, which is the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf in the country. So of course, you know, a surprise perhaps that, you know, the independents won these many seats. So that's a surprise for me. The surprise is not, you know, how the PMLN has performed. So I think it's to everyone's surprise, and mainly that happened because of a higher turnout in terms of voting in the country. More and more people went outside. Many would call it maybe a sympathy vote for Imran Khan or his party, because, you know, he has been, you know, as people believe, he has been mistreated by the courts and also by the military establishment. So there could be an element of sympathy vote, but Pakistan's demographics are also very important in all of this scenario. We're talking about almost half of the country's population, which is within the youth bracket, very, you know, tech savvy. They use social media and so on. So they're not, you know, unlike the previous generations, they're not dependent on state-controlled media. They're receiving more and more of their information through social media, you know, you can say sources. So the dynamics are very different, and that played out quite clearly in these elections, and how, in the manner in which all these independents have won so many seats. This is unheard of. I don't think so this would have happened in any other country, that the independents won the majority. Independents are the largest party, but basically they are, you know, PTI's quoted independent candidates and not technically independent like in the previous elections.
And my understanding is that the independents under Pakistan's constitution can't form government. It's political parties have to play that role.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, ultimately these independents have to, I think they get about a couple of weeks or so, they have to side with a political party. They have to go under the umbrella of the political party to be in the parliament. So the time is running out for Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf even to be in the opposition, because the party for now, you know, doesn't exist. They didn't compete as a party in the elections because of all the legal issues that they faced, and that's how they ended up losing their electoral symbol as well. So going ahead, I think for PTI, they'll be talking to maybe, there are not many like-minded political parties as far as Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf goes, but they do have a couple of options, and I think they'll eventually go under, you know, another party's political umbrella to be in the parliament.
I just want to step back to talking about the electoral process. You touched on you know, I guess the issue of rigging as well as the suppression of the PTI. How do you think these factors, and we saw a lot of violence during the election process. How do you think these factors impact the legitimacy of these results and the public's trust in the democratic process in Pakistan?
You know, to my surprise, the elections were held relatively peacefully as far as the process of voting goes. You know, all the trouble started happening when the election results were delayed, and in many of the places, you know, there have been allegations of rigging and misconduct and so on. And this is unlike, you know, previous elections. In previous elections, there used to be more and more incidents of political violence, targeted torture and killing and so on. And this, in this case, it is happening more like post the voting process, not the electoral process, because the Election Commission of Pakistan, which even coming into these elections was very controversial. There were questions raised on the chairman of the Election Commission of Pakistan, or his neutrality, for example, or his suitability. So even coming into these elections, you know, this wasn't a very sort of ideal scenario in which one would expect free and fair elections. But then, you know, as the results were delayed, this added more to the worries and concerns, not only in Pakistan, but around the world. Because now we're talking about a new era in which even if you cut down the internet, which they did during the election day, still people had their smartphones. They were able to record wherever they witnessed, for example, incidents of rigging or misconduct and so on. And those videos are now widely circulating through social media and other sources. In fact, Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, they have got all those, you know, official paperwork from many constituencies where their candidates were winning, and in the end they lost, and those you know, official documents have been circulated through various sources, including even Google Drive, because their website has been blocked in the country. So I think this, you know, when we talk about the establishment or other political parties, I think they're still using their old tactics that are not producing their desired results in the current context, when technologies and social media are playing an important role as far as the social fabric of the country is concerned. So going ahead, I think, you know, because of all these allegations and clearly, you know, the scenario in which one party has been mistreated or targeted by not only, you know, major other political parties, but also mainly by the military establishment, these concerns will remain. Eventually, if they have to find a solution for the stability of the country, they have to communicate with Imran Khan, or they have to involve Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf in any shape or form. They have to reach a compromise. Otherwise, the turmoil will continue, and Pakistan, unfortunately, or you know, the millions of Pakistanis will unfortunately continue to suffer because of this instability in the country.
So I think from what you've been saying, it sounds like you know, the formation of a coalition government is probably imminent. Now, Nawaz Sharif has called for political consensus to address the crisis that you're talking about. How do you perceive the dynamics between the different political parties, especially in light of their historical rivalries and the influence of the military?
You know, before PTI or Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, of course, it was Pakistan Muslim League, Nawaz versus Pakistan People's Party, historically. Especially in the 90s, there was one government led by, for example, Nawaz Sharif, then Benazir's government, then back to Nawaz Sharif again, and so on. Okay, so this used to be the case. But then came another actor, and a major actor, which is Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf. And when Imran Khan was removed as a result of no confidence move in the parliament, there was a government which was, to many people's surprise, you know, a government comprised of so many parties that historically never got along well under the umbrella of Pakistan Democratic Movement. So this can happen again, and already there have been meetings taking place between the leadership of Pakistan People's Party and Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz, and you know they have been discussing with other parties like Pakistan or Mutahida Qaumi Movement in Karachi that has won around 17 seats, if I'm not incorrect. So the marriage of
Was that
Karim,
surprising, Sahid? Would
yes,
you say?
yes, of course, because in the last election, PTI or Imran Khan's party was the most dominant party in Karachi, and still, of course, again, you know, there are many people who are going to do, seek justice through various courts, first through, of course, the provincial high courts, and even there is the option of Supreme Court. But I see very little hope because the judiciary has also been, you know, very controversial in recent years. So it's very little likelihood that many of those results will be overturned, but there might be, you know, one or two cases here and there where perhaps there is sufficient evidence or where there are stronger candidates backed by PTI. So, for example, you know, there is likelihood of that happening, but I don't think so that would affect the formation of any coalition government because the numbers are already in their favor. So, for example, this marriage of convenience between, let's say, PMLN and PPP might or might not work. So they're both, you know, we have to look at different scenarios. They have their bitter experiences from recent past when they were under the PDM government. You know, it was a difficult sort of, you can say, marriage of convenience between them. And also, it's very difficult. They'll come to an agreement on who's going to be the prime minister. Pakistan People's Party clearly wants Bilawal Bhutto, who was foreign minister and then the previous government, to be the next prime minister. And PMLN, of course, wants Nawaz Sharif to become the prime minister for the fourth time. And while they could agree on something, no one wants to be the next PM for, let us say, for two and a half years, because this is the crisis period. If, you know, they'll have to make difficult decisions in relation to fix the economy, to deal with security, to deal with other challenges, and they won't like to leave all of those, you know, the outcomes of all of those efforts for the next PM. If they reach, if they agree on any formula like that, you know, they can, you know, share the prime minister's position for an equal number of duration, let's say 2.5 years, because it's a 5 years term in Pakistan. So at the moment, you know, it could be anyone's guess, because it's very difficult, I think, for even these two major political parties to reach an agreement on some of the key issues. And similar with the case of MQM from Karachi, they would also like to get a piece from this big cake, as far as, you know, some of maybe key ministerial positions are concerned. For example, there are other parties who are, you know, very small actors. They might not be having a substantial amount of bargaining power, but they are significant. For example, Jamiat-e-Ulama-e-Islam of Fazlur Rahman. There is Istiqam party, of course, and there might be, you know, other from Balochistan as well. Balochistan National Party has also won, I believe, a couple of seats. So going ahead, if we look at the case of Pakistan historically since 1971, whoever wins in Punjab is important because, you know, this is the largest province of the country in terms of population, largest share in the national parliament. And here in the Punjab, we don't have a very clear result. Independents have won, but that's not a party because PTI couldn't compete as a party in these elections. So the next, of course, PMLN has the majority, and PPP has only received a handful of seats in Punjab.
So I wanted to focus a little bit on the role of the army in politics. How do you see the military's influence evolving after these elections, particularly considering Imran Khan's allegations against them.
This is not something new. Imran Khan, for the past 3 or so years, there has been a head-on collision between Imran Khan or his party and the military establishment. That was the starting point of how his government was brought down, and how the military has actually worked to support other political actors, in this case Nawaz Sharif, who was in self-imposed exile in London for a number of years and returned. And of course, the rest is just history. We can see how his party has performed in the elections. But as far as the military's image, I think military has, the biggest blow, the military has received the biggest blow in terms of in relation to its involvement in the politics of the country. Of course, it was always controversial, but it was in many ways very, very hidden or secret, which is no longer the case because of social media. Again, people have this level of awareness. People are already criticizing the role of the military. It is no longer that sacred sort of institution that no one could talk about. Now people are talking about it. Going forward, the military, I think, will have to rethink its approach towards its interference in domestic politics of the country.
Now, this changes. Is this something that the military is particularly concerned about? The sort of the mounting, growing criticism in the country
They should
about.
be, and they are already, like they're I think the approach they are using, in my opinion, is not the right approach. The right approach could be to understand what's going on and accept the will of the people and accept the reality that, for example, who is the most popular leader in the country, which party has received the mandate as the result of, or the largest mandate as the result of these elections, and accept the reality. But the opposite is happening, and what the military is trying to claim or trying to do is to counter this narrative, counter these perceptions through different, press briefings, through media reports, and so on. And historically, military has been actually very successful in this. But as I said before, people now have multiple ways of obtaining the information, so they are not just exposed to one narrative, I think, because of social media and so on. And that's why the government, when they get frustrated, they resort to their last option, which is to just cut down the internet, because they cannot control those narratives or transform those narratives. I think this has added to the military's frustration. And eventually one would expect that they would understand and they would negotiate with Imran Khan or with Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf and would let them become a part of the parliament or the civilian rule in the country. But it looks very unlikely in near future. There are, of course, many things still undecided. It very much depends on how this new government is going to operate, and it's not going to be easy looking at the number of serious challenges for the country. There are challenges in terms of economy, looking at, for example, the exchange rate between Pakistani rupee and dollars. That is, at the highest level ever. Income inflation is very high. Unemployment rates are very high. But on top of that, there are other political challenges. In Balochistan, there is an active insurgency. Pakistan's tribal areas, or Fatah, were only recently merged into Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. But they're still, under the influence of many terrorist groups like Tehrik-e-Taliban of Pakistan. So there is this level of fragility in the country as well. And on top of that, Pakistan has foreign policy challenges. Recently, there were troubles between Iran and Pakistan, and we know the situation in terms of Pakistan's relationship with India. But also, since the Taliban's takeover, the relationship between Pakistan and the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan has been very frustrating, and it's it's going down and down. So Pakistan doesn't have many friends in the neighborhood, but China, for the time being, which is heavily invested in the country through China-Pakistan economic corridor. So one scenario, of course, for China also, this is not an ideal situation, but China historically has worked very well with all political actors in the country. And I just scanned through, election manifestos of all major political parties. China-Pakistan economic corridor is big on their agenda. Doesn't matter who comes into power. So there's hope that they are trying to revive economy through more investment and so on. But it's not going to be easy if the country continues to face a political turmoil, because that would eventually lead to a very unfavorable kind of environment that would not attract foreign investment that Pakistan need to stabilize its economy and overall create other favorable kind of scenarios in terms of socioeconomic development in Pakistan.
I think you've touched very much on my next question, which was going to be about what are the key priorities for any new coalition government that emerges. I'd be interested to know a little bit of your thoughts on that.
I think economy remains the biggest priority. Pakistan has gone back and back to, for example, IMF, World Bank, to its, strategic allies or friends in the Arabian Gulf region and elsewhere, in seek of support or in search of bailouts, for example, and so on. No leader wants the country's economy to be like this, or to be dependent on other states or organizations. But that's very much the case of Pakistan, with a very high population growth rate and high stress on its economy. That will remain the biggest challenge for the country. But how that is going to happen, it's like someone, it's not a quick fix. So whoever is going to form the government, it's not going to be an easy run for them for at least the first half of their tenure, for 2 to 3 years. And they'll face a lot of criticism, but they'll have to make difficult decisions at the same time. IMF would keep asking to make certain reforms. There'll be difficult decisions made, or they'll have to be made by the government in relation to privatization of public institutions. Already, Pakistan International Airlines is, I think, in top on the list in terms of privatization in the country. And this will lead to a lot of job losses in the short run. And eventually, if things go right and the economy is revived through whatever required measures, then maybe the government can, catch its breath. But it's not going to be easy at the same time, because the country has a long history of massive corruption at the highest level. And this is what Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf wanted to counter as well. They have also faced similar allegations too, and this is International Accountability Bureau will have to come up with perhaps new mechanisms to keep a very close watch on how the sitting government operates. Always, National Accountability Bureau has to work on cases against previous leadership, and no one is paying attention to what's going on and how corruption affects the overall performance or overall good governance in the country as it evolves, for example, or as it progresses. So I think all that will have to be done, but it will eventually depend on the political will of whichever government or of whichever form it is formed, whether it is a joint government between PMLN or PPP and some of the other smaller parties. It will depend on their political will. If they are going to go by their old tactics and again not being very sincere to the country by letting all the corruption to go on and the level of bad governance to continue, it will not be easy for them, because the dynamics in Pakistan have changed, and whoever will side with them will also face the same level of criticism. And in that case, that is, of course, the military establishment of Pakistan.
Can I just quickly ask you, you touched on CPEC. I just want to ask you a question on geopolitics and international relations. Where is US-Pakistan relations at the moment? And is Pakistan a priority for the US?
I don't think so. Pakistan is a priority for the US. It has something to do with, of course, the troubled history of relationship since 1947, when Pakistan was established. And there were periods of high level of cooperation and trust, and then decades of mistrust and the lack of cooperation. So we are going through another phase, and the relationship is not very good because of a number of reasons. Although Pakistan supported the US in its negotiations with the Taliban, but there are so many other, you can say, bones of contention. And one is, of course, how Pakistan is hedging in terms of its relationship with China and the US at the same time. Of course, it is in Pakistan's interest to maintain good relations with both the US and China, but it's never easy for any small country or developing state which is economically dependent on many other countries or close partners like the US and China. But on the other hand, if you look at the case of the US or overall the West, they are deeply engaged in other urgent matters or matters that need their more attention. And the Russian military intervention or invasion of Ukraine is, of course, on top of their list. There is a there's then the crisis in the Middle East as well. So Pakistan is, of course, not a priority. Pakistan will have to adjust to this reality, and this has played a much bigger role in Pakistan's foreign policy orientation as well, as the US is more focused on other countries or other conflicts or security challenges. Pakistan has no better option but to keep depending on its relationship with China. And more of that will happen. Of course, the US will find it very difficult to deal with Pakistan or the leadership there. And in the recent past, of course, for the US, Imran Khan would be perhaps the least favored candidate in Islamabad, because when his government was brought down, he blamed the US for doing that. And there was a whole case around the leaking of state secrets or cipher in the country, for which even Imran Khan was punished in the court recently. So there's very little hope of, I think, the US-Pakistan relationship reviving very soon or going back to where it was during the war on terror. But there have always been such scenarios in the case of the US-Pakistan relationship, because whenever Washington has needed Pakistan, it has quickly healed all the wounds, and that could happen again. And that happened during the Afghan-Soviet war. Before that, Pakistan was facing international sanctions or sanctions from the US. But when Pakistan was needed, the relationship quickly recovered. And same was the case during war on terror. So there have been these ups and downs in the US-Pakistan relationship, just like, I believe, any other relationship.
Sounds like convenience makes all the difference.
Absolutely.
Dr. Zahid, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dr. Imran.
You're listening to South Asia Chat. You can learn more about our work by visiting us at isas.nus.edu.sg. You can also get updates on our research and publications through social media. You can find us on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram.